Your relationship with your body is the longest relationship you will ever be in. You must have unconditional permission to eat in order to make peace with food. What is your self-talk like about your body? If you wouldn't say that to a loved one about their body, what makes it okay to say it to yourself? This is a safe virtual space where we are going to dig into deep heart-to-heart combos that all come back to our relationships with food and body. Welcome back to another episode of the Find Food Freedom Podcast. This is your host, Sam Previtt, and I'm delighted that you're here. Especially if you clicked on today's episode, you're looking for support to support somebody with recovery, whether that's healing from an eating disorder, disordered eating, maybe they're on an intuitive eating journey. So I was so, so grateful to have Melanie Rogers on the podcast today. She is the founder and CEO of Balance Eating Disorder Treatment Center, Melanie Rogers Nutrition and Redefining Wellness. And we talk all about how to support a loved one going through recovery. Now, Melanie, because she, again, owns the Eating Disorder Treatment Center in New York City, she has a very different perspective than me. The Find Food Freedom practice, we are 100% virtual. We are outpatient. We are helping people going through intuitive eating, where Melanie's practice is definitely helping people that are in active eating disorders or recovery, but just a different level of care. So it was so cool to have her expertise, her knowledge, her wisdom, and really ham and egg this conversation, if you will, of how to support a loved one. We mentioned a bunch of great resources on the episode itself, but something that Melanie had mentioned after we got off air was this Poodle Science video that I had never seen before. So it is linked in the show notes. I think this is an incredible resource if you yourself are going through recovery and you're trying to explain size diversity and health at every size to a loved one. This is such a beautiful analogy comparing human beings to different dog breeds. Your girl loves an analogy. So again, it's called Poodle Science. It's linked in the show notes. Please, please, please watch it. Share it with a loved one if you're trying to explain what you're going through. And this is just such a great episode. If you are the one going through recovery and you need help explaining what you're going through to a loved one, or if you are the loved one trying to support someone in recovery. So thank you for being here. We, both Melanie and myself, care so deeply about our clients and people that are actively going through recovery and choosing to pursue food freedom. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode with Melanie Rogers. All right, Melanie. So before we jump into the topic, which I really want to get to today, I do want to hear a little bit of your origin story. I know I have your bio and things like that, but did you always think that you were going to be an eating disorder dietitian? Was this what you grew up saying, I want to be, or how did you come to this work?
Yeah, not at all, actually, Sam. I didn't even know that there were people called registered dietitians, and I certainly eating sort of dietitians, right? So what led me to this work was actually a family incident where my grandmother had really struggled with her weight and then had a fatal heart attack. And I was quite young at the time. I was 10. And I remember going to visit her in the hospital, and I grew up with both grandparents very close by in a small country town. So they were a very big part of our lives. And I remember while I was there and, you know, knowing all the different things she tried to do to be healthier and all the things she was supposed to be eating and not eating and how difficult it was. And I was in there seeing her struggling after her first heart attack. And I just thought, you know what? I want to be a doctor. I want to be a doctor so I can prevent people from having heart attacks. I want to prevent this from happening. And so I was, you know, went through school, did all my sciences and got to university thinking I was pre-med on that track. But then as I started to learn more and more about what doctors do, I realized that they don't do prevention. They work with people after the fact. So I thought, okay, what can I do that is more in the role of prevention? And then a good friend of mine at university introduced me to the concept of being a nutritionist. She had, you know, learned about this area, and I thought that is exactly it. So I went on the course to become a registered dietitian. I came out here to the States actually to do my master's in clinical nutrition because I wanted an international, exposure, and also because coming from Australia, the research in the US is there's a lot more money in the research here because it's a larger population. So I wanted to be closer to the research, and I chose New York specifically because at the time there was an obesity research center here. And so I thought, okay, that's exactly it. My grandmother struggled with, her weight. That's exactly where I want to intern and hopefully work in the future and learn all I can and be a nutritionist who works with people who struggle with their weight to prevent heart disease. So I ended up interning there and then working there. And lo and behold, I was introduced to something called binge eating disorder. And they had a multidisciplinary team of an RD, a registered dietitian, a psychologist, an MD, a psychiatrist, and a sports physiologist. And I thought, this is it. This is it. This whole calories in, calories out, and there's no understanding of your relationship with food and the emotional relationship with food. Like, that's old school. This is what I want to get into. And so I was introduced to binge eating disorder before it even had a diagnosis. I recognize that my grandmother may have struggled with that or some kind of emotional overeating. And then as I went to conferences to learn more about this, I started to put the pieces together around other eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And then I also realized that I had had my own full-blown eating disorder in my 20s before I came to the US to do my master's. So there was just a, like, you know, ching, ching, ching kind of moment of just all the boxes being ticked for me. And I realized, not only because I'd had my own lived experience and also witnessed my grandmother's struggles, that I had a unique perspective on working with eating disorder clients. And then, of course, got as much training as I could possibly get, because there is no training. You have to cobble it together.
Yep.
And so here I am now as a certified eating disorder specialist. Yeah, that's the journey.
Well, thank you for sharing all of that. And it's so cool to hear all of the different pieces and kind of how you came to it and how much unlearning and learning we have to do to get to where we're at. So grateful to hear your story. So as you support people and your practice supports people with eating disorders and disordered eating, I think one of the common questions we get is how to support people that have eating disorders, specifically in the home. And this is a thing we have too with clients that pops up a lot, where they'll be coming to us, they're really making progress in their sessions, and then their partner isn't sitting in the sessions with them and is really struggling to understand what they're doing, what progress looks like, right? What this journey is, especially if they come from a very disordered background where they were always the one dieting or counting calories, and now it feels like a 180 of what we're doing. So I would love to hear, you can start wherever you want. I know we have a lot of different questions we can go to, but when someone says to you, like, how would you support a loved one? We could speak specifically on partners today. How would you support a partner with an eating disorder? What are the first things that pop up for you or that come up for you?
So how would I support a partner? So if my partner had the eating disorder, how would I support them?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, you have to get yourself educated. So I think that the biggest barrier is that we are all inundated with diet culture. And as we know, diet culture has been conflated with health and wellness, you know, thinner is healthier, etc. So as you said, Sam, it's a lot of unlearning. So, you know, I think the best thing that a partner can do is get into some of those sessions, get some of their own readings, going to some different groups and learn the language and unlearn a lot of the internalized weight stigma and bias that we all have. So I think that the key thing that that I'm wanting to be able to do for my partner is to know what triggers them and what doesn't. So, you know, I think that not talking about body shape, size at all, nothing about body shape, size, even looks, I don't think is something to say. So, for example, you can say to your partner, gee, you look great today. And if they're struggling with an eating disorder, we know that they're going to hear, oh, I've gained weight. If you're saying healthy, that's really just another word for weight gain, right? It's so sneaky the way that this eating disorder works. So, you know, I would try to create an environment where there's no conversation, no comments, absolutely none about shape, size, body, appearance. And even down to, you know, I was really thinking about it, Sam, even when you're like watching TV and you might be watching with your partner and you may just automatically make some comment about someone that's in the show, for example, you know, oh, that person looks this way or this person looks that way. Or even last week, I was 2 weeks ago, I was at the US Open tennis and thinking about comments about the players there. So instead of talking about what they look like, talking about, oh man, what a great backhand that person has, or what a great serve they have. So talking about what people can do and what their body does, as opposed to what their body looks like, I think is absolutely essential. Including, as I said, appearance, you know, you look great in that outfit. That's also going to be interpreted negatively. So that's part of the language piece, I think, that's really, really important. And the other piece I would say is around food. And so what we've come to discover is that people label food, good food, bad food, healthy food, unhealthy food, clean food, you know, et cetera. So taking away all the labels, taking away all the labels of food and neutralizing it and then walking the talk with that. And also not saying, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to need to do an extra workout tomorrow if I have this dessert tonight, things of that nature. You know, some of this stuff, Sam, is so automatic that people don't even realize they're doing it. And so I was thinking of a journal prompt for loved ones to even grab a journal and write down over a 24-hour period just how often they think about or are about to say something that's about weight or appearance or a judgment on food, just as a little exercise for yourself to get a sense of how much this comes up.
Mm, I love that.
Right. And then the very last thing that I'd want to say is to for everyone, including ourselves, and I've taken it myself, the Harvard University's implicit bias test for weight. And I took that years ago, Sam, kind of, I will admit to being a little cocky, thinking, oh, yes, you know, I'm sure my score will be low because, you know, I've done all this training. I certainly don't harbor weight bias. And I was really humbled to see the score. And, you know, the reality is that we are absolutely inundated with this stuff. We have all internalized it. So we're all going to have weight bias, whether we realize it or not. And actually, Siobhan Turner, who was the former founder of BEDA, Binge Eating Disorder Association, she has now developed the Body Equity Alliance. And she was just saying in something I just read recently that she takes that weight bias test every year to see what she's doing. And she herself is someone who comes from a background of binge eating disorder and has struggled with her own eating disorder and is in a higher weight body herself. So that's really interesting to hear that she's actively working on that as well.
Thank you for everything you just shared. We can definitely link the implicit bias test in the show notes so people can access that a lot quicker. So I love that idea. I think some of these tangible things are really helpful. And I think, it's so hard, as you know, who someone is, you're so in the work, right? Like you're so far in it. So to try to pull out and be like, okay, if I knew nothing about this world, what would I, how would I start this? Or how would I, you know, tell someone? And I love the idea of journal prompts or even just little exercises with your partner, because I think so many times partners genuinely want to be supportive, right? But they don't know that they're triggering their partner. And even the word, you kept saying language. I wrote that down. I circled it because I think that is such a big one. Even thinking about the word healthy, right? Asking your partner, what does that mean to you? Or how would you define that? And sitting with that and being curious. So are there any other things like that that come up for you of maybe questions we could talk about? Or I love this idea of building a journal prompt or exercises, reflection questions with partners that they can sit down together and say blank. Another one that's coming up for me, for example, is maybe adjectives that you think of when you think of fat versus thin. What adjectives come up for you, right? What would you put with that? So is it within? Is it successful? Is it motivated, disciplined? With fat, is it lazy or unmotivated or undisciplined? You know, these kind of things to see where we're at. Like, and again, this is all, I'm kind of bouncing off of exactly what you said, but trying to put it in different words too, to give people ideas. So anything as I talk, are there any other exercises, journal prompts, things that you're thinking of?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the body positivity movement and some of the great work out there with the Body Positivity Project, they have a lot of that sort of stuff, Sam. Awesome. So a lot of resources out there actually that people can tune into, check out, and then sit down and explore with your partner. And I think what's so important here, you highlighted it, Sam, most partners absolutely want to help and they just don't know how to. And then, of course, they're walking on eggshells because we know what it feels like, or at least I can speak from experience, that, you know, sometimes no matter what our partner says, they can never say the right thing and they feel pretty crushed and defeated. And so to have something very tangible you can work on together to give them prompts, you know, like this is better if you say this versus if you say that, can be really helpful. And I'll also say to the partners that sometimes you will follow that script to a T, and on that particular day, it won't land with your loved one and they'll say, don't say that. And so I just say, don't give up. But that is the nature of the illness, is, you know, just sometimes that particular phrasing works and other times it doesn't. And that's going to be part of how difficult this illness is and the emotional roller coaster that it is.
Mm. Thank you for stating that. Yeah, I think a lot of times we all just want answers. It's almost like diet culture, right? Just tell me how to lose weight. And it's like, no, same thing here. It's like, just tell me what to say. Just tell me how to be the perfect partner. And we, again, coming back to that intention of like, we want to be supportive. We want to be on the same team. How do we get there? So for partners who have a loved one who's recovering from disordered eating or eating disorder, what can they expect from a, and again, everyone's journey is different. Like, I feel like we could give 1,000 disclaimers here. No one person's journey looks the same, but what can a partner expect progress to look like? Because again, coming from diet culture in a world that's so driven by numbers and sizes and these silly metrics, what does success or progress, not success, what does progress look like for someone recovering from an eating disorder?
Oh, great question, Sam. And usually what a partner is looking for there is something very concrete, mm-hmm. because it can feel very, non-concrete is the word that comes up, but very like ethereal, like it's kind of like, yeah. You know, it feels so shifting like sand, you know, and the reality is that we try and talk about the quality of recovery. So instead of focusing on, okay, is my loved one, you know, weight restoring if that's necessary, or, you know, Are they eating X number of calories, et cetera? We talk about behaviors that are shifting. So, for example, we will use percentages. All right. So when your loved one joined us in our program, they were only eating one meal a day. Now they're eating two meals a day and, you know, 50% of a third meal. That's success. Right. Yes. And the goal is, of course, we're going to get that client, hopefully, to be able to eat three meals a day at 100% and then have some snacks in there. So it's about stages, and it's about helping loved ones understand that at this stage and compared to where the start point was. I think that's so important to be able to truly see what those successful steps look like and that we are seeing them. So other things that, you know, we might talk about is if this is okay to share with the loved one, of course, you know, the client, our client was purging daily and now they're purging three times a week. That's a huge success. That's over a 50% reduction. So using behaviors and then quantifying them can also be extremely helpful. If someone was over-exercising, you know, we might say, okay, your loved one started at this point, this amount of mileage a day, and now they're doing 50% less of that on average per day. That's huge success. And we want to get, you know, the next stage would be to get them to here. So that's how we talk to loved ones about the measures of success. And that's quite different to how we might speak to the insurance companies. Some of those factors we certainly do share with insurance companies and they do lean into that, but often weight is one of the biggest data points that they tend to hinge a lot of decision making on. And it is not as helpful as one might think. So we definitely try to move away from that when we're talking to loved ones and even with insurance companies. So those are just a couple of things, Sam. You know, we could go on with different things such as, you know, if our clients are now able to make some basic meals for themselves where before they couldn't, can they even, you know, tolerate being in the kitchen and preparing food, touching food, things of that nature. And then another thing that we look at is many of our clients come in with a really reduced number of foods that they may eat. And so we know with recovery that two things are hugely important, an increase in variety and an increase in the fat content of foods. And so we're able to then say, okay, you know, when your loved one came in, they were only eating X, Y, and Z, and now they've been able to incorporate A, B, and C. And then over time, we hope that we're going to see further and further expansion. So we talk to loved ones about what the research tells us as far as what milestones we hope to get to with their loved one that we know sets them up for a better prognosis and a better chance at recovery.
Mm, thank you so much for highlighting all of that. That's super, super helpful. I'm thinking of specifically, and this might be a little bit more related to the clients we service, how we're more in the outpatient disordered eating realm versus eating disorder. But something that comes up for us a lot is our clients are learning how to be body positive, right? To accept their body. They are walking away from diet culture and subscribing to the idea that smaller bodies are better bodies. And I find that a lot of partners will say, okay, sure, like you need to believe that because either you have an eating disorder, right? So you need to, air quotes, gain weight to be healthy, just you. But the world still can work on intentional weight loss, or the partner themselves, right? The partner might be on their own, air quotes, health journey of whatever that means, right? Different behaviors. So when it comes to a partner being on their own diet culture journey, and then you have this other partner who's in recovery, whether from eating disorder, like a lot of disordered eating, do you think that they can coexist and be together? And how do we have those conversations, or how do we start those conversations peeling back kind of challenging belief systems?
Oh, it's so hard, Sam.
So difficult.
Now with GLP-1s, we have a lot of family members who are on GLP-1, whether or not.
And we can go that way too if it's not a partner. It could be a parent. Yeah, it could be anyone.
Yeah, all partners, you know. So it's so difficult. And again, bringing it back to having some difficult conversations, you know, right down to asking the partner, even is there a way that for right now you might not necessarily suspend your health journey if they're watching what they're eating, etc. But could they do it? Could they suspend it? You know, is it something that they could do in a different way that's not around the food, but maybe, you know, you're doing a little bit of exercise or other areas of health while your loved one is recovering? And then the goal is, so there's a couple of goals here. One is the immediacy. Okay, your client, your loved one is in treatment. This is very expensive. This is very time consuming and it takes everything out of them. So for this stage, is it possible for you to suspend what you're doing to support them? And if that's too much and they say, no, I've got to be healthy as well, we then try with all the different education around the conflation of, you know, being smaller or being thinner and health, so that they can get an insight into, you know, diet culture and honestly the lies that we've been told. Not always successful because it's hard, you know, like even our medical doctors still think that, you know, thinner is better and healthier, so let alone for the general population. And so it can be really hard. So a couple of things we recommend is, can we have those conversations? Can you suspend those pursuits for right now to support your loved one? If not, even getting down to maybe even eating separately, which I hate to even recommend, but it could be something like that, which, you know, talks about separation, and I don't like that. But again, I'm talking about different stages. And right now for this stage, could this be the better option? Or when you are eating together, could you try to eat in a more balanced way that echoes what your partner's doing? And ongoing therapy together, talking about diet culture is so, so important. And also educating the partner, as we spoke about earlier, around this idea that we've all drunk the Kool-Aid. And while health is important for everyone, losing weight is not necessarily the way to go with respect to being, you know, the healthiest version of yourself. So, Sam, it's so hard. It's so, so hard. So, again, conversation, education, and then when all else fails, maybe just kind of having different environments.
Yes. Thank you for that. And I couldn't agree more that it's hard. I've sat with so many clients. I know our team has, where it's, you just want to shake them. But mm-hmm. I like to remind clients that when they're having these difficult conversations, can we try to put ourselves in the partner's shoes where we used to be similar to the partner, right? Yeah. And we used to have certain belief systems, or we used to do certain things around food, or so. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to, you know, be around them. Like you said, you can remove yourself from things, but to try to be able to see, like, okay, they, like you said, they drank the Kool-Aid. They're drinking the Kool-Aid, and it's important to give them grace or empathy to an extent, of course. Everything, there's so much nuance to this conversation, so it's so hard because we're not talking about one specific person.
Yeah, so much nuance, you know, exactly. And as you said, that was our belief system. You know, as registered dietitians, we were actually trained to think, believe that, and practice that. And then we had to do our own unlearning, which was excruciating and infuriating. And once we got a hold of the research and realized that our training was so out of date, you know, that's also infuriating. And what's interesting, Sam, as just a little kind of add-on there, with the coming out of the GLP-1s and, you know, the proliferation of the uptake of those, the pharmaceutical companies have been saying in their marketing campaigns, you know, we've known for a long time that people, you know, really struggle to keep weight off, which we've been saying all the time, right? Diets, 95% of diets fail. People can lose weight, but the body fights back. And 95% of people will regain weight plus some. We've been saying this for 15 or 20 years. And therefore saying, you know, recommending a diet to a client is like saying, take this pill, but you only have a 5% chance that it's going to work and there's going to be some awful side effects. But I'm still recommending you take it. Would you take it? No. You would say, give me something better. And so now the pharmaceutical companies, without even acknowledging that, you know, oops, we were telling you all this time, without even acknowledging, they just completely slipped into, yes, well, we've known this for so long. And so now we've got a medication that can help you. I thought the gall of it, you know, I was outraged to see that. But at least they're saying, hey, weight loss and sustaining weight loss is actually, you know, the body won't do that. So at least there is some messaging now around that hopefully could also help persuade some of our loved ones.
Yes, the GLP-1 era, we are in it. It is everywhere. So that is a great kind of tie over as we head into the holiday season and the events, you know, celebrating, we're around food, we're around people that have their own relationships with food and body that is much different than our own. How do you help arm clients walking into these situations, or what would be some tips you would give people when it comes to boundaries with family members around food or body, how to know when to engage in conversation and when to walk away and what feels right for them? Again, I know a lot of nuance here, but would love to hear your go-to thoughts.
Absolutely. Preparation is key. And we're all going to have an Auntie Marge or an Uncle John who's going to make some comment about your weight or how you look or whatever. I mean, here's an example, Sam. I was in the lobby of my building a couple of weeks ago, and a former employee of the building was there just visiting, and she saw me and she made a comment on my weight. And I haven't seen her for 2 years. And I was struck that this person I haven't seen for 2 years, who was, you know, an employee here in the building, felt that they could make a comment on my weight. And so, you know, fortunately we're well enough trained to let that, shake that off. But the fact that I'm bringing it up just speaks to how inappropriate that is.
Yes.
You know, and so I'm just speaking about the general population. So in other words, if someone that barely knows us is going to comment about our weight, you can be sure our families will, no matter what you say to some, actually. So this is where it gets tricky, because some families and some loved ones are really good at respecting boundaries when you ask them to. But in the world of eating disorders, I found that a lot of us come from families who are really, really bad with boundaries.
Yes.
That's part of the problem.
That plays into it all.
Right. So no matter how much you ask and advocate for yourself, they may still just completely dismiss your requests. So you have to kind of know your audience and know what you're getting into. So I've got a couple of things I recommend to people. So if you can, if mum and dad, or mum or dad, or mum and mum, or whomever your family is made up of, if you can have a conversation with them prior, a week before, and just say, hey, you know, folks, I'm coming home, would love to see you. Often there's a topic that can get us into trouble, and I really want to focus on enjoying my time with you and spending quality time and getting closer to you. I'd like to request that this particular topic is just off the table. Could we agree to that? No comments about blah, 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 blah. Are you in agreement with that? That would be really great. And so preparation ahead of time. And then, of course, there's going to be the grandma or the auntie that, no matter, even if you do call them and ask them that they're going to say something. So I tell my clients to go in, have a friend, like have a support person, or have someone you're going to call. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes into the whole, hello, how are you all, that you can call to just vent, and just go in knowing that they're going to say something. And my suggestion is just to say, hi, it's lovely to see you too. Don't engage, and then move on. Hello. Yes. Anything you too, don't engage, move on. Yeah, just don't engage. Just don't engage. Yeah, because if we, And that is so hard to do. And I know that's so painful. And you want to kind of, I'm a pacifist, but sometimes you do want to kind of, you know, strangle someone. But just best to move on and go and keep your safe space and go and vent to whomever else is safe there. And that's why having a buddy can be really helpful too, I think. Yes. Also just, you know, making use of the ability to go outside, take a breather, walk around the block. In other words, have a plan. So not only just have a plan of speaking to whom in advance and then on the day what to do, but also have breaks for yourself so that your whole central nervous system doesn't get elevated to the point that you're at spillover mode.
Yes.
Keep yourself as grounded as you possibly can. Do whatever you can. And if that means, you know, you're only at Thanksgiving for 2 hours instead of 4 hours, or you come in a little bit later, you leave earlier, you take breaks in between, whatever you need to do to get through that very, very difficult scenario, I highly recommend, because your recovery is the most important thing.
Mm, I love that. It goes back to that protecting your peace. I love that you were just like, don't engage, because so many clients, you know, I've had conversations where it's like, but then I feel like they're winning, you know, air quotes winning, or it's not your responsibility to convince anyone, to defend anything. Your peace, your recovery is so much more important. Their comments on food and body have everything to do with them and nothing to do with you. So the more that we can, like you said, prepare to. Preparation is so key, because I always say it's on us if we're surprised that they make a comment, but we're totally allowed to be upset, angry, frustrated, all these things. You can feel all the things, but you know that Aunt Cheryl's going to say that shit every year. So let's go in prepped, ready to not engage. I love it. And I think it's just so helpful to have the buddy, or like you said, you just walk away or don't even engage in it. So
no. And those conversations are for later when you're in a better place, a much better place. And maybe then you might want to go and sit down with Aunty Cheryl, as you just said, and say, hey, you know, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, there were times when you said some things that I felt, blah, 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 you know, the whole I thing. You know, there's a different time and place where you could go back and try and help them to understand. And also know that, unfortunately, they're just a part of this culture. I actually think also going in almost like a researcher. So imagine this wasn't even your family and you're going in observing these people in their natural habitat.
I love that.
You know, like, and so that gives you a little bit of space from yes. whatever they'll do. You're the observer, right? And who are these humans in this little family and what do they talk about and what comments do they make? And then, you know, it can help to have that distance so that you're not so sucked into it, because, you know, again, our families are talking about things that that they've picked up from the society that we live in, and this society, unfortunately, is still a long ways away from, you know, getting rid of diet culture, you know, and that is the sad reality, but it is the reality. So I think we have to be realistic that we can't have a complete diet-free, you know, situation. Gosh, it'd be fantastic if you could.
Wonderful.
I think it's probably really difficult to get to that place. So in the meantime, going with your armor, with your plan, with your ways of taking care of yourself.
I love that. I love the observer. I'm going to definitely write that one down and remember it. Because I've had over the years, I forget who told me this one. It was maybe a mentor of mine, of when you're in a situation where you feel the emotional charge, you feel yourself building, to take a beat and say, like, how would so-and-so respond? And it kind of in that same breath can get you out of your body and be like, oh, okay, how would Mulaney respond to this? And then they might be able to pull from your wisdom. And it's so funny because it's like, well, she's not there. They're not there. But it helps you remove the emotional piece and kind of respond in a different way. But I love that. I'm going to just be observing all my family at all events. And it's harder for us because they see what we do, right? Or they know what we do. Oh, but almost I get more comments because of that. And it's like they want a battle royale. And I'm like, I just walk out of the room. I'm like, I'm not engaging with this. I'm not engaging.
Absolutely. I have, Sam, people, you know, get a cat made observer, t-shirts, observer, coming with your little notebook. You know, I don't know. I'm just playing. I'm just spoofing off that. But oh my goodness. Absolutely. Keep the distance.
I love it. So I think one thing I want to come back to, but give a little bit more tangible takeaways for people to do a little bit more of the teaching here, is the language piece. I would love to identify with you a few things. It could be mantras, it could be quotes, it could be lines that people say all the time that is in fact diet culture and harmful. For example, or harmful in the sense of like triggering to our clients. So when someone says like, oh, I'm going to have a cheat meal, like to that person, they might think it's just a cheat meal. They're going to, you know, what that's what they subscribe to, but how triggering that can be to our clients. So for any loved ones, supportive partners listening, what are some everyday things that we hear in diet culture in the world that is actually harmful harmful language?
Oh gosh, unfortunately, there's so much of it.
Right? I know, we could come up with like thousands right now, but just whatever comes up for you that you hear a lot. Absolutely. And you could make it, you could think of holiday scenarios too, of how just the same kind of chatter comes up, I feel like every year.
Yeah, so the classic, you look so healthy, right? Mm-hmm. Is read as blah, 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 blah. The whole, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to work out extra tomorrow if I have this extra slice of, you know, pie at Thanksgiving. That's always one. I didn't eat breakfast today so that I could save my calories for Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, I did that for so many years. So many years.
Yeah. I'm not going to need to eat for the next couple of days, you know, after Thanksgiving, right? The whole, oh my goodness, I have to undo my pants here because I've eaten too much.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they sound so basic. They sound so normal, but they can be so triggering for people. Other things such as, oh, I'm wearing a dress today I haven't been able to fit into for two seasons, which mm-hmm. means lost weight. Over the dinner table, things like, oh, we're having a competition at work about who can lose, well, this is obvious, who can lose, you know, X number of pounds in a month. We're having a health club.
Or a transformation challenge, they'll usually call it. I hear those at like so many fitness centers and stuff. As soon as I hear that, I'm like, here we go again.
Transformation. Oh, I love that. There's, you know, I think what is important to note is that, you know, we used to call it diet culture, and now it's this whole health and wellness.
Wellness culture.
A wellness culture. But the wellness culture is really just the same umbrella as the diet culture. It just sounds, I don't know, cooler maybe. But it's the same stuff, just dressed up slightly differently, really.
Totally. I love that you called that out, because people are like, I don't diet. I'm doing it for my health.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Exactly. So those are just some things that come to mind, you know, or someone, you know, wears a pair of those sneakers that, oh, you know, apparently I burn extra calories by walking in these different sneakers. You know how they have those kind of shoes that.
I've never heard that.
Yes.
I'm not surprised. That's on me if I'm surprised at this.
I think that might be a little bit dated. I think those sneakers came out just before COVID and everyone was wearing them in New York City because apparently it was extra exertion with the way that you walk that you would burn off extra calories. Oh, I'm not joking. It's crazy stuff, right? Well, people are now talking about walking around in their weight vests. You know, they wear these.
See those all the time. I'm like, do we really need those? Like, can we just go for a walk?
Yeah. And then I think also what's really tough is, you know, if I'm thinking Thanksgiving and I'm thinking of different generations of the family there, and there's going to be women who are probably going through menopause or who are gaining weight as they're aging. Yes. And so I imagine there's going to be talk about that as well. And do you know, actually, true fact, Sam, from Margot Main, who's a wonderful researcher in this field, she was talking about that the average woman who goes through menopause, average, gains 15 pounds. And the research has actually suggested that this is protective weight that we need to gain in order to protect our bones and muscles. And so, you know, the whole call to action was, instead of saying, oh my gosh, I've gained weight as I'm going through change of life, in fact, the reversal of that would be to say to yourself and your friends, are you taking care of yourself? Have you gained your 15 pounds? How about that for a spin on its head? Anyway, so that might be something you might want to say as people are talking about gaining weight at the table, or just leave the table. you know, there's often that kind of talk. And then I'll say that also gets convoluted with aging and all of that sort of thing, as we also live in a very anti-aging culture as well. But those are some of the different things. Or, you know, someone at Thanksgiving might say, okay, so I didn't use oil in this one, I just used or I steamed these and I held off on this sauce, or this is actually, you know, a low calorie sauce that we added, or I used half the sugar in this one, you know, or I used applesauce instead of sugar. All those little things that hint at calorie reduction, you know, eating less, eating fewer calories, and all in the name of so-called health.
Yes. Thank you for highlighting all of those. That was incredible. And I think if we have, you know, partners listening or loved ones listening that want to be supportive, that's just so helpful, because they might not think of that as harmful to us. We're so deep in the work that we can spot these things so easily. And it just goes back to that journal prompt that we started this episode with, is I love that simple takeaway, that actionable item that we can walk away from this episode and think, okay, how often do I think about food and weight, or how often do I open my mouth to comment on food or weight or what I'm going to eat or what someone's body looks like, what my body looks like, anything related to that. I think that is such a great place to start. And as we close out here, I know you mentioned the Body Positive Project. I love the Alliance for Eating Disorders. They have some great resources for loved ones. Any other resources, whether it be yourself and your practice, any other resources that you would love to highlight for partners, loved ones, supporting someone with eating disorder, disordered eating?
Absolutely. We direct people to NEDA, the National Eating Disorder Association, and they have a wonderful toolkit. They have toolkits for different groups of people, and they have a wonderful toolkit for loved ones and how to respond and support your person who is struggling with an eating disorder. And it's got some great scripts and great lists of the do's, things to say, the do's and the don'ts, what not to say. And also, they also have support groups. I think ED Alliance, obviously, that you just mentioned, Sam, they have support groups as well. We actually run a family group once a month for our clients and their family members, where we do a lot of this education stuff, Sam, in addition to then weekly groups, individual support groups with family members and their loved one, as a way of trying to, whether their loved one is a grown adult or a teen, actually, so it doesn't matter, because all families are completely indoctrinated with diet culture because of the society that we live in. So it's so important that we can try and give them the tools to best support their loved one, because no one gives you a manual, right, and says, okay, your loved one has an eating disorder, this is what you need to do. So we try and help and support them with those kind of resources as well.
Yes, that is incredible. Thank you for that. And if someone's listening to this and they want to learn more about you, Melanie, where can they go? Where is the best place for them to go?
They can go to my website, which is balancedtx.com. That's balance with a D, tx.com. You can check us out there. We have all information about our programming and resources also for loved ones and for those who are struggling. And yeah, we're very excited to, you know, be here today, Sam, with you and, you know, trying to build awareness around eating disorders and supporting those who are struggling as well. So thank you so much for your time today, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Find Food Freedom Podcast. Every single time you listen to an episode, it truly makes our dreams come true, helping people make peace with food, body, and movement. If you have not already, please make sure to head over to social media and give us a follow at find.food.freedom on Instagram or Find Food Freedom on TikTok. And if you resonated with today's episode and want more professional support, please head over to findfoodfreedomresources.com. This is where you can get your benefits checked to see if your health insurance will fully cover that one-on-one nutrition counseling with our team. And we also have so many other virtual resources there. So again, that's findfoodfreedomresources.com for all things Find Food Freedom and to get those health insurance benefits checked. If you have not already, I invite you to rate, review, subscribe, like, share this podcast with anybody that you think needs to hear it. The more that you share this podcast, the more that this message of intuitive eating and food freedom will be out in the world, which we so desperately need. Again, thank you for being here. I cannot wait to chat with you again soon on the next episode of the Find Food Freedom Podcast.